So in today's episode, I talked to Malcolm Harris, author of Kids These Days, and many other books, but specifically today we focused on Kids These Days and generational trends, what it means to be a kid, a Gen X, a Gen Z, etc., and mental health among teens. This is another episode that I filmed in my series for a class I'm doing, and I think it's a great episode on what has changed since Kids These Days, and how we will continue to see the world shift and rebuild around teens. So I hope you guys enjoy. I have a bunch of questions. So typically I start with like, what has changed since like X, Y, Z? But I think with kids these days, I feel like we should tackle it in two parts. So like first, what has changed about millennials? What has surprised you about millennials as they've, you know, grown and changed? What has surprised you about that?
Oh, about the cohort?
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything that, like, in particular that surprises me. I feel like a lot of the things that are in the book, like, happened, right? There's been more, like, formal union organizing than I expected. But a lot of those haven't gotten contracts yet, so we'll see how it all actually shakes out. Well, in terms of predictions, that was one that I didn't get right, that I thought formal union activity would continue to decline, and there's been sort of a resurgence. Other than that, I'm not sure.
I agree. It's interesting to me that millennials have, I think the predictions about the child, like raising families, that has held true, but I'm surprised more millennials haven't bought houses. I think that's surprised me.
Not me. I mean, I think that was one of the predictions that, because the prices have gone up and the labor share of value production hasn't. So
right.
They keep getting more expensive. So, and they're not building very many more of them. So
yeah.
You'd think they would, based on like the normal development pattern, right? But I think part of why I wanted to write that book was to show that that was something we take for granted, but shouldn't. And I think the shouldn't is showing itself now.
Yeah. And in terms of the unionization, do you think that has to do with COVID and, you know, the rise we saw after COVID in the amount of available jobs and kind of the influx of like worker power?
That was part of it. I think you saw the federal government forced to like give people money and give people unemployment. So the costs of unemployment or not having a job were low. And for some people, they were lower than having a job. It was, but you're better off not having a job for a small amount of time. And so I think, yeah, workers did have a lot of leverage. At the same time, what COVID really represented was everyone's jobs getting much, much worse very quickly. So if your job gets like way, way worse very quickly, but your money didn't like double, right? If you're working at a grocery store, like your job easily got twice as hard. But it's not like you got paid twice as much for working at a grocery store in COVID. You got paid the same amount. So I wasn't surprised to see the labor response during the COVID period. But it's so long now that like COVID is forever.
I think that's interesting too, because that goes back to one of the points in your book about how worker productivity has increased, but the amount of pay has not like kept up with that. The increase in pay hasn't kept up with that. So what is the difference between, you know, if worker productivity has increased, but pay hasn't increased, why is it that after COVID, unionization increased as productivity increased?
Yeah, so like I said, you've got the quality of jobs decreasing rapidly with COVID. So you saw people coming together to defend whatever job quality they already had in the face of jobs getting way worse. So one of the ways that you can protect your job quality is by unionizing. And so I think that's why you saw people coming together at the same time.
Yeah, I guess I'm just skeptical of that because, you know, in terms of, you know, the ratios, in terms of like the speed at which they've been increasing, it seems like jobs have been getting worse for a long time, right? Like if pay hasn't been keeping up with productivity, then jobs have been getting worse. So is it just the collective moment, like the impact COVID-19 had, that finally forced people to say, like, look, our jobs are getting exponentially worse now?
Yeah, well, and you have a whole history of organizing background, right? So like, union organizers haven't necessarily spent a lot of time organizing low-wage workers. And so as a lot of work transitions toward lower wage service work in this country, then you're going to tend to have lower union density. And we've seen over the past couple of years that an understanding that these are not temporary jobs, that service jobs, even if they're not paid very well, are worth organizing, and that these are real jobs that aren't going anywhere, held by real workers. And so I think over the past, 10 years plus, we've seen unions and workers themselves understanding that more and seeking to organize lower wage workers. The idea that there's a like real substantial Starbucks unionization wave is pretty wild to me, because Starbucks always represented the opposite, right? The death of union work.
In COVID, there was a huge like cultural naming of like workers as like essential, right? And we saw like, you can't go to the grocery store and not have like a cashier there, like you have to get food. And so these people are actually like even more, quote unquote, essential than many of the people you think of as essential, like, I don't know, lawyers. I mean, I guess lawyers are pretty essential too, but there was just a huge naming.
Like, we were paid better, right?
Yeah. And so I think probably putting the name of like essential workers on these kind of like lower paid jobs might have also contributed to the fact that people were like looking around and saying, no, my job is very valuable and I deserve to be getting paid more for it.
Yeah. And hopefully people in general, people, even ones who don't have those jobs, but are just customers and users or whatever, remember that time, because I find people forgetting very quickly how much they rely on grocery store workers, for example, when things get tough and when there's an emergency, that the grocery store, people who work at the grocery store stocking the shelves, are the difference between you having food or not.
Yeah, I think for Generation Z too, this is going to be one of my questions. After COVID and during COVID, we kind of saw what technology can do. Like a lot of us were in school and we're saying like, this is awful. And what a world with just technology looks like is not a world we want to live in. So I wonder if we will remember that after COVID, or if we'll just forget all of our experiences and, go beyond Meta first.
Well, it's a conflict, right? There's a set of forces that want to use this crisis opportunity to transition our form of social organization to something that's worse than before, and something that is sort of tech mediated for everything. And then there are people who are looking at that experience and say, well, this really shows us what we don't want, and that we can organize and come up with something different and think about a different way to live other than pandemic forever. And other people are looking at pandemic forever and thinking like, oh yeah, like our stocks went up. Like, if you're the guy who owns Zoom, you think pandemic forever is great and we should just use Zoom for everything.
Yeah, I will also say about the pandemic, like I started this podcast during the pandemic, and I think it would not have been as accessible for me to talk to people living in different states and countries, et cetera, without the pandemic. And I would never have even like had the means to do so. So I think that's also kind of interesting. We think of it often as like this awful, the pandemic was terrible. I'm not trying to say it wasn't, but I do think it's interesting that technology, at least during the pandemic, there was some good that came out of it.
Well, change is always interesting, right?
And yeah.
So have an experience. I think there are a lot of positive experiences people had with forming like neighborhood organizations as well. And crisis can definitely bring out new frames for how to live. Rebecca Solnit has a really good book called Paradise Built in Hell. That's all about disaster communities, what people do when there's a disaster and how they build community, mutual aid communities to respond to disasters. And I think we saw some of that during the beginning of the COVID pandemic. How much that's going to last, or how much people like kept those skills, I think remains to be seen, because we're going to have more crises, right? Like, we know that for sure. And they're probably not all going to be pandemics. Some of them might be, but people, lots of people have already experienced worse crises than that since then, especially if you like live in Pakistan, for example.
I wanted to ask your thoughts. Do you know TikTok?
Only a little bit.
So on TikTok, there's like a side of TikTok that's like called Book Talk, where basically people like talk about the books they like to read. Like Colleen Hoover is super popular. I think one day she sold more books than the Bible, which was like a record. And I think it's interesting, going back to the point about my Gen Z after COVID, that we've seen a rise in like reading as opposed to, you know, playing on your phone, and also that came out of TikTok. So I was going to ask you what your thoughts are on TikTok.
TikTok and Book Talk is really interesting. It's so new. It's very exciting for me as someone who, you know, writes books for a living, that there's a platform where young people are getting like super excited about books, especially someone who's now selling a new book. It didn't exist last time I was selling a book, and now it's like, oh, whoa, this can dedicate tons of attention to a particular book. And so, yeah, the Colleen Hoover phenomenon has left the entire book publishing industry just like totally perplexed, and they don't know how to do that. And at the same time, they all want to do that. So I love Book Talk. Book Talk should, you know, read my books and talk about it. And it's great. Any attention that people are paying to reading, even if it is just like a sort of aestheticized version of it sometimes, even if they're just like books look cool, so you want to like show all the books that you have, even that I think is still better than what it was like maybe when I was growing up, even where books were not cool. Books are totally cool.
Yeah.
Those books for a living.
Yeah. I also do think though that probably has a lot to do with COVID, like people seeing that, you know, being on their phones is not great all the time, and almost, you know, rediscovering books, this thing that's been around for, you know, so long. I wanted to ask about that. And then on the same topic of social media, I feel like I have to ask about your thoughts on Elon Musk buying Twitter.
Oh, geez. I really didn't think it was happening. I lost $40 on bets because I bet it wouldn't happen. And I, for a long time, I was sure I was going to win. Yeah, not great. We'll see how long he can hold on to it. I think people like Elon Musk are mostly good at selling the idea of companies. And so I don't think it'll take very long for him to take the company back onto the stock market and try to get people to take most of the company, or at least a substantial part of it, off his hands. And I think ultimately the people who own it now are almost all looking how to stop owning it as soon as possible, hopefully without, for them, losing as much money as they can.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of a recipe for disaster if you like buy something and all you want to do is get rid of it. So, but like, what do you think that will mean for Twitter as a platform?
Well, we can look at, when you talk about buying something and trying to get rid of it as fast as possible, that's like what the whole private equity industry does. That's like what there are whole areas of finance, huge areas of finance, where that's all they do. They like buy a company, mess with it, sell it again. And usually what they do is they make it worse. You cut costs, you sell the assets, and you make it leaner and meaner, and you like expand in a superficial way. So maybe you start seeing some of those signals in what he's saying now, but I don't put too much stock in the things that someone like Elon Musk says day to day.
I do think that, first of all, he's going to have two kind of like forces pulling him in opposite directions. Like he wants to, you know, almost deregulate Twitter. And right. Also at the same time, like keep as much money as possible and like not lose a whole bunch of it. So I'm not sure what'll happen to Twitter and like if he will just fully commit to, you know, bringing Trump back on the platform, like taking away all of the kind of bans, getting like the B account back. I don't even remember the name.
Right. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, clearly he has a political agenda, and it's not that unusual for people in Silicon Valley, the kind of political agenda he has, and it's a negative one. So I don't think it bodes well for anyone. I'm still stuck on there because, again, I gotta promote my writing. I gotta sell my books, and that's the platform that I use the most. But maybe I should switch to BookTok.
So in terms of like Occupy, I think Occupy had a huge Twitter presence and like spread a lot on Twitter. So what do you think that like this public forum that has been used to organize is kind of going, is dying down, or at least maybe getting worse with, you know, Twitter owning?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how effective it was for organizing. I mean, I certainly used it and other people used it. So I think it was part of that moment for sure. Mm-hmm. Part of it that we sort of forget now is just having these public spaces that everyone could just go down to the park. So mostly the way people participated was not by like logging on and seeing what was happening, but literally just like walking down to the occupations, which is different than I think the kind of political participation we've been used to. I guess the uprisings in 2020 were more like that.
I do a little bit of like climate activism. So I've worked with Sunrise Youth Hub in the past. And I do think though that maybe not Twitter, maybe Instagram, but I do think there is some merit to like the organizing of like rallies and social protests on Instagram and Twitter. And I also think that maybe this is a little more with my generation, but I think there's kind of a hesitantness of our generation to do something if it's not planned. So like people want to know ahead of time. People want to know like 3 days before an event happens so they can like check their calendar and like block off a chunk of time. And I wonder, because I don't think that a lot of people who I know at least would have, you know, I think we would all be a little bit busy and we would like walk by these protests and say like, oh, I'll go the next time. Like I want to find out beforehand. So mm-hmm. I do wonder if that's like a generational change. And so I guess that leads me to the other question I was going to ask, which like the big question, which is, how do you think Gen Z is different from millennials?
Well, let me take them one at a time. Because yeah. The first one, you're talking about a sort of temporality, right? Like a sense of time. And one thing that like, maybe you'll read Walter Benjamin at some point, but he talks about revolutionary time, and that revolutionary time works different than regular time. And so regular time, when you're thinking about your schedule and you're thinking 3 days ahead or you're thinking 2 weeks ahead, and you're taking for granted that like the situation is going to be the same now that it's going to be in 2 weeks. Like if I've got a flight that I'm planning in February, I'm assuming that society is going to be like basically the way it is now that it's going to be in February. But in a revolutionary moment, moments that feel revolutionary, and I've been in a few, that all goes out the window. Like you don't know what you're doing tomorrow because you might be in jail, and you're willing to like find out what's going to happen. And situations where you're willing to find out what's going to happen, I think have more potential than other ones, right? Where like, if you're like, oh, we're gonna do this action and maybe we're gonna get arrested, but we know we've got it planned out. We already know we're gonna be out by tomorrow and I've got my math test on Friday. So like, this is all part of the plan. Like, then the police know what you're gonna do. People generally know what you're gonna do. It has the timing and a sense that can be understood and that fits within everyone's plans. And so I think there's limits there, right? To things that are planned. And I don't think, like, obviously during Occupy we planned stuff as well, and certain things were planned publicly and certain things were planned privately and whatever, but there's something we said for spontaneity, and the plans that you make hit reality. And I remember the first night that Occupy Wall Street started, when it like really started, I was already at a backup location because I assumed that the police were going to, and a bunch of us were, because we assumed that the police were going to clear the first location immediately. And that didn't happen at all. And so we had to like adjust to that situation. And I think your cohort, my cohort, everyone's cohort, if we don't have experience doing that, then we're not in a very good position, right? We're not in a very good position to challenge other people's plans for what's going to happen if we're already fitting our plans into them. So you gotta be ready to meet history where it's at, which is exciting and scary and definitely sometimes makes you miss your math test.
Yeah, well, before we move on to the other thing, I do think with like the Black Lives Matter movement, we were able to do that. We had like a sense of crisis, and so people were just stopping whatever they were doing and just like going out on the streets. So I think that might also be a flaw in the climate movement that I've kind of felt for a long time, of there isn't really, you know, the deadline's not tomorrow, it's in a couple years, and then a couple years, and then a couple years, right? And so there's just this sense of like, the world's not going to stop immediately, so let's put things in our calendars, versus the world's ending tomorrow, we have to drop everything.
Yeah, well, and it makes it hard for people to believe, I think, climate. And I was with like Bill McKibben and like Power Shift One and like, you know, climate movement when it started in like 2008 or whatever. And I think it's hard for people to believe the climate movement because the actions aren't really commensurate with the crisis itself, which is hard because the kind of actions that are commensurate with the crisis itself are like totally illegal and like really crazy. And you'd be like, to be as destructive as global warming would be to be like, you know, Thanos or whatever. You have to like wipe out half the earth. But at the same time, it's hard to treat the situation with the level of emergency that it actually demands. And so if you see a climate march and they say like, you know, the world's ending tomorrow, and then tomorrow they're planning to go to their math test, you're like, well, you don't really believe the world's ending tomorrow, so you're exaggerating, or like you're doing this for some other reason. You don't mean this. You're not ingenuous, which I don't think is true. I think that most of the people who make up the climate movement, especially the young people, are serious, really believe the things that they're saying, but probably don't have the like experience, background, and I think partly guidance from older people about how to make that felt and how you can approach society with a real intent to change it. At a certain point, you can't let the people who are in charge be in charge anymore, right? It's like at a certain point, you stop asking and you stop lobbying and you start fighting. And that's, I think, we're close to that point in a number of ways. And I think young people understand that, but probably unless they're part of like specific political traditions, which some people happen to be, they don't necessarily have examples for what that looks like besides the things that they've seen.
Yeah, I think my immediate reaction was also, yeah, we also don't want to, you know, get kicked out of our houses for, you know, protesting instead of going to school.
Yeah, and it's harder and harder, you know, if back in the 60s, right, if you get kicked out of your house, it was easier, way easier to find a place to live, to find a job, to afford to live in a city where you know people or whatever, to way easier to afford school. It's like, it was way easier to afford being disliked by your family, and like forming your own individual life was way cheaper. And so I think young people are responding with, if they like are a little bit more careful with their lives, they're not wrong. They're responding to like a real historical difference. But at the same time, like what, they're not wrong about what that future looks like when they like really look at the numbers and think about it. And you're like, it's like, okay, you can try and like be smart about protecting your future, but if you think about that in an individual term, it's not going to get you very far if like the world is in crisis. So it's really hard weighing, and that's why, to go to the next question about what has changed, I mean, I think you all are experiencing that more acutely, but it's the same crisis. Like, we're confronting the same thing. And you know, I wrote my book about millennials in like 2015, probably most of it. And my range for millennial birth age is 1980 to 2000. So I wrote the book when the oldest millennial was like 35. So if there's another cohort that starts at 2000, I don't think you can really like start producing thoughtful work about the meaning of that cohort. Like, you couldn't write an equivalent like Kids These Days book into like at least 2035. And think about like how different the world is gonna be in 2035. It's like crazy different, right? Like, I can't even imagine what it's gonna look like in 2035. But that's when we're actually going to have a sense of what the next cohort is, I think, is sometime around there, and what the differences are. right now, when I talk to young people, and I've been talking to young people pretty much every year since this book came out, about the book and about the ideas and about like the problems that they see and how they're approaching their world, it sounds very similar to the problems that I ran into and the like long-term historical problems that I was running into as a young person and that like my cohort's running into. It's a different context, but like the history itself is the same. We still haven't solved this problem, so you're still gonna run into it, hopefully like with us. And I think when you look at like politically, like opinion polls and age-based breakdowns and stuff, we're in basically the same club. It's called the Bernie Sanders Club, I guess, like demographically. Whereas Gen X is like some way somewhere else.
It's interesting because a kind of tangent, but also on track. My teacher assigned us a project of doing a podcast on a specific topic. And so a set of podcasts on a specific topic. So I chose looking at like teen trends and the shifts in generations. And so I've also recently, and it was funny because I had already had a podcast. So he basically like assigned me something I would have just done on my own. And I was like, perfect. Yeah. And so I recently interviewed the author of Excellent Sheep. And he recommended this book, iGen. So I've been reading that. And
oh no, he told you to read iGen? But iGen's terrible.
Okay, so tell me why you think iGen is terrible.
I wrote a whole review of it. I mean, so I quote her, you should look up my review of it. I wrote a review of it for New York Magazine. She's a consultant, she's selling stuff. I'm skeptical of all the consultants who wanna label new generations as fast as they can and get paid to do it. I thought that book was lousy. I think that's funny that he recommended it.
So why did you think it was lousy?
Well, she doesn't look at any of the actual history. And so she's very focused on literally the iPhone, like not even, and you'll probably, if you read it, you'll read it, see what you think. All the like interface with technology that she's describing is probably going to seem really antiquated to you because it is old. And even though it's supposed to characterize your whole generation forever, it's like, oh no, like we don't do any of that anymore. Like that was 5 minutes ago. And so she's basing these like historical descriptions on something that's really epiphenomenal, something that goes like really fast, especially nothing goes faster than like the way you use particular consumer technologies. And I'm skeptical about like phones make you sad.
Okay. So that's interesting because that's one of the things I'm trying to focus on is there has been a huge increase in the amount of like unhappiness, especially among teens. Mm-hmm. So if it's not the iPhone and it's not technology, what do you think it is?
I think there's a lack of autonomy in young people's lives. And so when you're talking about, oh, we can't do anything without scheduling 3 days in advance. That's terrible. That's like, that sucks. What a bummer way to be young compared to like having control over the way that you spend your time. So one of the things I talk about in kids these days is that over time, a cohort of young people have spent less and less time doing things that they enjoy doing and more time doing things that they don't enjoy doing. And I think it's like, that's very clear and makes way more sense to me than like phone stuff or any like, cause like really you can replace like internet time with TV time. And it's just like a shift from one to the other over cohort. It's like Gen X spent just as much time looking at screens. It was just a television screen instead of a computer screen. And now you all like do not watch television, just like don't do it. The idea that you're spending way more time doing like scheduled activities, like school, it's mostly school and like extracurriculars and being lectured and homework and time with your parents. And less time, unscheduled free time with your friends is basically the only thing teenagers enjoy doing, according to like time diary reports. It's that and eating, which is often also the only like unscheduled time that you get with your friends. So for me, it comes down to that. It's like, why you have to spend more and more time working, which is what it is, it's work, right? And less time not working. Of course, you're gonna be more unhappy, especially as young people who really shouldn't be working partly because they're not getting paid to work anyway.
Yeah. That's interesting, though, because I think one of the things she says is kids would be way happier, because I did actually read the book. I finished it a couple days ago. But yeah, instead of reading your review on it, I was reading the book. So sorry. Sorry.
Well, now you can read the review and see what you think.
Yeah. One of the things that she does talk about is how kids are spending less time with their friends, and that's bad. And we in-person time with their friends. And so they should be spending more time in person with their friends. So that's similar to what you're saying. And I also think that, you know, she does a good job of talking about the ways in which, you know, we see a decrease in like autonomy in terms of like parents are continually like interfering in their children's life. We are seeing this trend of parents continually like spending more time with their children and lacking autonomy. So what do you think, what societally has shifted there?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? And that's what she can't answer.
Right.
And so I think that one of the questions, and you see the same issue with young people working as well, like fewer and fewer teenagers have jobs, like where they go and work for money. Why do kids not have time to hang out or to work? Why do they have to spend all of their time becoming, you know, enriching themselves for the future? Why is young people's time worth so much more learning, which is what they want you to spend all this time doing? It's competing for college spots or whatever, but it's learning. It's supposed to be learning, becoming better workers or more appealing future workers. Why is that so much more important now than it was then? And why has the capitalist system found childhood as a place to like get more and more out of? Is a really deep question like about this economy and about capitalism and how it works. And it's one that they like have not offered very good answers about. So I have some, I hope, I think, about what has happened over that period and how declining output productivity has led firms and society as a whole to look for places where they can decrease waste, where they can juice more out of time that wasn't being used the most efficiently before. And I think children has been a big one of those places. And young people have been working a lot more, a lot harder over the past 40 years, 50 years than they did before. And I think that's why, right?
I wonder though, because I find, and you know, I think this is true kind of across the board, you know, we see a lot more jobs now where you have to, you know, you have to have like interpersonal skills. I mean, maybe it's like less, but anyway, there's still a lot of jobs that have interpersonal skills. And I think that our generation is kind of lacking in those because we're not spending as much time with like our friends, and we're not like developing those kinds of skills, the skills that you get from like being with friends, like talking to people and learning about their lives and kind of like empathy as well. And so I wonder why capitalism has started, you know, promoting like learning trigonometry over like learning skills that could also be seen as just as useful for like work, like productivity.
Yeah. And I wonder, well, partly because it's not very good at knowing what it needs, right?
Yeah.
And so you set up these incentives, and because it's not planned, it's not actually conscious. And so you set up these incentives where people compete against each other and the results are terrible. And you're like, oh shit, that's not what we wanted exactly. And it is a self-destructive system. And so by getting what it wants, it undermines itself. And I do wonder if then you'll have like richer kids, parents saying like, no, we need to like set up more play dates, or we need to create more like interaction opportunities, or else like Billy's never gonna be a good lawyer because he's just gonna be too weird.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe. So these job markets are not actually meritocracies, and neither are the college admissions markets. And so those like weird kids with bad social skills are still going to get the jobs where they're in charge of people. So I would not be surprised to see that that's a bad combination. Maybe we're seeing it now with someone like Elon Musk, for example, who like gives off this real huge vibe of having very bad social skills. It's really funny, actually, because my new book is about the history of Silicon Valley. And you have this progression from like the first round of Silicon Valley guys who invented the first microchips and led those firms. They were all like homecoming king, football captain, best guy in the school. They were all, everyone really liked them. And that's how they got those jobs, is because they were really well liked. And then you had the next, so the next group of guys were these like really mean nerds, Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, who people didn't like them, but because they knew more about computers than other people, it didn't matter if people didn't like them. And they really enjoyed people not liking them. And now we've got these group of guys like Elon Musk who sort of want to be both, but aren't either. And so like they act like they want to be like popular celebrities and like they're huge antisocial geniuses, but really they're just like guys who happen to get lucky and are jerks. I guess we'll see more of that, right? It's like the fact that people don't have social skills does not prevent them from ruling other people, unfortunately.
Going back to something you said a little bit ago about the play dates and parents setting up more more time for their children to have play dates, I think that might be true. My mom has already started encouraging me to see my friends more instead of doing all this school.
I think there's a book about it. Here you go. Parents, Children, and the New Expectations of Play by Tamara R. Moose.
So I should have read that instead of iGen.
Yeah, right. I think that's like a study of Brooklyn, of like kids in Brooklyn at some like high school or something.
I live in Brooklyn.
Well, there you go. You might be in there. You never know.
Well, I don't go to school in Brooklyn, but I do live in Brooklyn.
It doesn't matter. I think it's like neighborhood based or whatever. Anyway, doesn't surprise me. But it's too bad, right? Because then it still becomes a parental thing. Then it's like back under the same umbrella. And is it really the same? It's like parents don't want you to go like loiter and smoke cigarettes in an empty lot, even though that's like probably what you should be doing developmentally as a teenager. Like there's got to be some disjuncture. And it gets really like weird when parents want you to do things that they don't want you to do. And then when they like need you to do stuff that they don't want you to do. So more teenage rebellion is hard for parents to encourage, right?
Yeah, right. It kind of defeats the whole purpose of rebellion if your parents aren't encouraging it. I know you're talking about your writing a little bit. So my teacher is a huge fan of yours. And one of the things he told me I had to do before this interview was read the piece you wrote on the fancy food convention.
Funny.
Yeah. So did you repurchase any of the products that you sampled at the fancy food convention?
That's a good question. You know, I don't think so. Any of the ones that I mentioned in that article, although I do see the fancy foods around, and then you also start to see like specific things that look like, you're like, oh, I know that. You must be at the fancy food convention. Like I can see aisle that would be. It's really fun. You should like find some way to go, or like it's not that hard to get in. And it's one of the like fantasy places that people don't know it exists. And then you get there and you're like, what the hell?
Yeah, I was struck by the fact that like if homeless people had a fancy like a press pass and could go to the fancy food convention, you know, they would be able to get food there. And like it's interesting that people who are more privileged in certain ways have access to free foods, and people who aren't less privileged, who need it more, have less access to that same free fancy food.
All sorts of free stuff, free houses, free trips, you know, look at the gift basket for the Oscars.
What was your favorite food you sampled at the fancy food convention? I feel like that might be like choosing between children, but.
I know, and it was like years ago at this point too. I think there was a adobo sauce that was my favorite. That now that I'm reminded of it, I should probably get it again. I think I'm gonna go look up whatever that sauce was and go like order it for the Christmas period.
Yeah. When you're in the like the grocery stores, what sticks out to you? What fancy food brands have you seen that like have made it and are now like on the fancy food shelves?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting now because it's the finance behind it all has gotten so developed. So you can tell when, I can start to tell when food brands have gotten private equity investment.
Yeah.
Because they start to pop up, and I drive my wife nuts by being like, Googling like what cookies, who is invested in whatever cookies, and like always coming up with whatever, like bank is actually bankrolling like Little Mama's home style cookies or whatever, you know? So you can find a lot about the world, increasingly amounts of the large amounts about the world by looking at the fancy foods on the grocery shelves.
If I was going to my local grocery store and I was just walking around, what fancy foods would I see?
Well, you should look at things that have like displays, right? Because those are the ones that they're pushing. And so anything that's like presenting itself as new, or a new kind of ingredient in particular, because there are very like vogue ingredients that they focus on. If there's a new like, yeah, it's like they say fancy foods, but that's just like the like official name for like snack foods or whatever. It's like the, I'm trying to think of it. It's like when hotels call themselves like hospitality or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like, it's the fancy food industry, but they just mean like snacks.
Okay, so have you seen Poppies?
Poppies.
They're apple cider vinegar like sodas.
Yes.
That's probably like a fancy food.
Exactly. Well, and so you, yeah, they've got a whole beverage section. And so I'm sure they've got like five different apple cider vinegar. I remember when I was there, they had one that was like maple sap. There were a couple maple sap companies that were trying to make that the new like lightly sweetened beverage. So there's big, huge competition in the lightly sweetened beverage, naturally sweetened beverage category.
Yeah. So just in terms of, I don't think we ever fully answered the question of how iGen differs from millennials. I know you don't want to comment on a generation that isn't, you know, fully developed yet, but if you had to, what would you say?
Yeah, I think you've experienced like acute crisis in a way that we hadn't quite. Like we had to like convince people that there was a crisis, and we had to like make the crisis visible, and that was an activity. And I think you've been been overtaken by the crisis history itself. So we felt like the crisis generation, but actually you all are the crisis generation, or we're one big crisis generation. Or generation will not be a useful way to evaluate our differing experiences. So I don't know. Like you said, I'm hesitant to weigh in on something that I don't think there's a lot of good evidence on. And I don't think we should base our opinions on these things on just sort of like vibes or anecdotes or your like impressions from people you know. We got to use actual science.
For sure. And in terms of the science, technology, how has it changed since kids these days? And what would you say has been like the biggest things you think could impact this generation, coming generations, and millennials?
I'm not sure we'll have that much to do with tech. I mean, obviously, like carbon sequestration technology is the most relevant technology to anything that you're dealing with. I think really the most remarkable thing is how little technological progress there's been, especially in terms of the things that we use. Like, I don't think TikTok is qualitatively different than Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook or Friendster or MySpace. And so the fact that they're refusing to innovate, they spent this whole like, you know, decade of low interest rates, investing all this money in just like the same bullshit over and over again, shows their lack of imagination and sort of the false promise of tech solutionism, right? You can't just like, there isn't a natural technology that's coming that's going to provide answers to our problems. And in fact, if we just give those people all of our resources and say, hey, you fix this for us, they're just going to find new ways for them to get rich, mostly by like making us annoy each other, because that's really easy.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the metaverse then?
I have no thoughts on the metaverse. It's fake. It's not real. There is no metaverse. There is just the universe.
There's just the universe. There's no metaverse.
Go outside.
Yeah.
Go smoke a cigarette in a parking lot. is my commentary on the metaverse.
That's your advice. And then do you have any just final thoughts before we end?
No, I mean, it's exciting to be hearing people still engaging with these ideas, engaging with them critically. So I'm really excited about what comes next. I hope that generational labels don't create a like artificial division between people who need to find a similar page to get on, because I think our fortunes are really like, you know, we might be 10, 15 years apart or whatever, more than that, got them 20 years apart. But I think our futures are wrapped up together, very much so. So that's how I'm looking at young people's future, is also as my future.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking to me.